find it right here.
Lack of an eye.
Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Information Technology. It's February 24th. This is an informational meeting only. Mr. McSpadden, will you please give us a very, very brief review of what we're going to accomplish today in an hour and a half?
Absolutely. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, as you know, the past few weeks we've had the Department of Administrative Services and the Office of the State Chief Information Officer come and give an overview of statewide IT from the executive branch perspective. Today we'll have representatives from the Oregon Judicial Department and the Legislative Administration giving you the rest of the story, a better understanding of information technology from a profile, a broad profile perspective in both the other branches. First up on the docket, we have the Oregon Judicial Department with an IT overview of the judicial branch.
Great, thank you. And you know the process. You pick whoever goes first. Just remember to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have the short straw, so I will be beginning today. And Bryant will take us into the bonus round. My name is Phil Lemon. I'm from the State Court Administrator's Office. Thank you for inviting us to come testify and explain how we handle IT projects in the judicial branch. We're going to give you a kind of a high-level overview of how our enterprise technology support is operated and spend most of our time talking about our major technology project, the Oregon eCourt program. And we are in the 15-17 biennium in the final stages of implementation, and just want to give you a preview of coming attractions. So as you know, we are the third branch. The major entity in the judicial branch is the Judicial Department. That is the state courts. We have a Supreme Court and Court of Appeals, Tax Court, and Circuit Courts in every county of the state. We also have a State Court Administrator's Office here in Salem, and that is kind of the DAS of the judicial branch. We also have the Office of Public Defense Services in our branch, and we do provide technology support for that entity as well. The Commission on Judicial Fitness is a one-person show, and so they kind of run on their own. So again, this is the court structure, the Supreme Court here in Salem, the Court of Appeals here in Salem, Tax Court here in Salem, and then Circuit Courts. There are 48 court locations throughout the state, but in each of the 36 counties. Back in the early 80s, these functions were all consolidated under an administrative program here in Salem with the State Court Administrator's Office. We call that a unified court system, and that gives us the ability to centralize many of the services and functions that we're going to talk about today. The other thing I would just say is the circuit courts are courts of general jurisdiction, so they do all kinds of cases. Everything from parking tickets for some cities, traffic tickets, all the way to aggravated murder. We have civil litigation of all kinds, whether it's employment contracts, liability, negligence cases, family law, any kind of domestic relations, dissolutions, juvenile dependency, whether it's foster care involved, all come through the courts. The criminal side, I think everybody's familiar with. And then we also have small claims and landlord-tenant actions that all come through our circuit courts. We handle about 500,000 cases a year, and each one of those has, either by statute or by judicial department administrative process, its own case flow and workflow. And so as we convert from a non-automated system to an automated system, we'll talk a little bit about what that means for our business processes and how technology is helping us accomplish that. In our administrative structure, again, this shows the Chief Justice, who is the administrative head of the judicial branch. Directly below on this graph is the State Court Administrator. She is basically the Chief Operating Officer for the judicial branch. And then in the State Court Administrative Office, we have a number of administrative and executive operations, one of which is our Enterprise Services Division, and Mr. Bryant Baer is the head of that division. And so I wanted to turn it over to him so he can get into the organization that he supervises.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Bryant Baer, Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Judicial Department. Let's talk tech. And what you see before you here, as Phil was mentioning, is the Chief Justice, State Court Administrator, and I perform dually in this organization. One is the director of the Enterprise Technology Services Division, and then two, I interact quite extensively with the Oregon eCorp program and its governance process there. So as you can see from the chart in front of you, on the org chart down, I answer directly to the State Court Administrator, who's the Chief Operating Officer. But then on the side, we have the Oregon eCorp program, which has its governance structure, which exists of the Chief Justice, the State Court Administrator, Presiding Judge Multnomah, and Presiding Judge Lynn County. And that's our way of managing the Oregon eCorp program consistently and effectively through the court system with stakeholder involvement. And then they also have the steering committee as well, which would be on a different slide. And so what you have is just our organization, basic organizational structure on how we handle technology and also how we handle the Oregon eCorp program, which encompass the circuit courts and the appellate courts. On the next slide, you'll see a high-level view of what our technology spending is. I'll start with the last bullet and move my way up. OJD's tech budget is less than 5% of OJD's total budget. We spend generally $19.6 million on various different operations, technology purchases, server licenses, various different ways of funding what we do from a technology perspective. Another $3.9 million in online or other funds to support some of our online services, with a total budget of $23.5 million in a biennium. 49 FTE is what my department is, minus the eCorp program. That has an limited duration staffing component to it, but our full-time general-funded FTE permanent positions is 49, which is basically 58% of the budget, with 42% going to services and supplies. When we talk about technology in the branch, we talk about a number of different things, like you had heard from Alex up here about a number of different things from the state perspective. We have the appellate court management system. That's a newer system designed and developed by LT Cortec that was deployed in the 2008-9-10 as our proof of concept for bringing a court from a case register-based system, COBOL, an old iSeries system, into a new, more robust SQL database interactive system. So the Court of Appeals was done in roughly 2010, proof of concept. So they're sitting on e-filing, e-payment, active case management, document management system. And then we use that as a jumping point into our next bullet, which is the Odyssey system. We ended up doing a procurement for a single solution provider, and we'll get into a little bit of that in a couple slides down. But that's in its deployment mode, and you'll see the charts on that as well. But that's for our circuit court systems, and that's the company that developed Odyssey was Tyler Technologies. And in addition to all that, we have various different servers. We have our state network system that we operate. It amazes me how we can now no longer live without email. And so we have a small team that makes sure our email system's up and running. We have a web presence, which you'll see in further slides, accounts for a decent amount of web traffic as it relates to e-payments and e-filings. We also have our legacy systems, which are slowly being shut down as we deploy the Odyssey system, and that's our iSeries. That's an IBM trade name for a COBOL-based that we used for our case register system, also known as OGIN, the Oregon Judicial Information Network, and FIOS. It was our financial system along with the OGIN. And so those are what's known as our legacy systems, which are being phased out in response to the Odyssey deployment. And then we have our integration. And so what we did when we decided to holistically look at how OJD does business, we realized that with our circuit courts, we do a lot of data transferring and a lot of information goes between different state agencies, collection agencies and such, which there is a slide on that as well. But we procured a rather robust BizTalk environment. And what happens is that allows us to facilitate a data transfer outside of our main production systems, which is basically the BizTalk filter. So we have a better way of focusing our data back and forth without disrupting production systems as we go forward. As Phil mentioned, we do support OPDS. We have a little bit of a support contract with them. And then we also support, most courts have a local technical support person there to answer questions, to reset passwords if a computer goes bad. We support that as well. And so on to our next slide. At our IT budget, we have our current service level budgets, which are coming to you in the Ways and Means for consideration. And then we have three policy option packages, which there's a slide or two on that coming up. So as we transition to the Oregon eCorp program, I always like to explain just very briefly the vision. Without reading it to you, of course, it's better access, better information, better outcomes. As we moved, it was very important as we started this that we had a vision for what we wanted to accomplish, and there it is, and it's been the same since the start of this program. So on the next slide, you'll see what is the Oregon eCorp program. That was our business transition started in 2008 with the appellate onto the circuit courts. It replaced our aging COBOL-based system. As of right now, I have 1.5 FTE who actually understand how the system works. Most retired, as they could. And so our timing was quite well as we planned this out. But most state and private systems are in the same boat. If they're COBOL-based, you can't really find a COBOL program anymore.
I am one.
Let's talk. if I can have your resume, co-chair. So this was our phase out of our COBOL systems, and we were lucky to get ahead of the curve on that. Our also goal was to have the electronic courthouse. How can we interact with our stakeholders and the public in a more of a robust way versus having to walk through the courthouse doors? And so right now, e-payment, e-filing, you can do a number of different things online with the court versus having to come in. If you're a bar member, if you're an interested party, if you're a debt collector, you now have access to documents online instead of having to come to the courthouse as well, or a data aggregator as well. And so we've started to push what knowledge the court has in a way that's safe and secure. I always try to mention that because people get very sensitive about personal information, social security numbers, date of birth, addresses. We have been very careful to open up those doors very slowly. What you may have heard about in your role as legislators of how come we're not getting this out quicker, we learned from other states that opened up the door very quickly and quickly had to close them. So we did it in a very methodical, well-thought-out way to provide the service but also to maintain privacy. We replace 50 million pieces of paper a year, and we have real-time access to the system. So if somebody files a document in a circuit court, within 2.5 minutes, that information is replicated onto another server, which is available to the public who have access to those documents 2.5 minutes later once it's in the system. So you don't have to wait a couple of days while it sits on the desk. Once it's entered into the system and scanned, it is almost instantaneously available to those that have that access.
I'm going to interrupt for a minute here, but I want to ask Mr. McSpadden, do we have time for a few questions in each presentation? Have you looked at the content?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, we have approximately 40 or so minutes for each party, so just a few questions with each presentation.
Okay. Two questions. You mentioned within a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask, what is happening in those 2 minutes? That it's not available. What protocols is it passing through, or what's happening?
Madam Chair, what happens is when it gets scanned into the system, it goes through a validation check by the person scanning it in to make sure what was scanned in was the accurate representation of what they just moved through the system. So they have to do that verification check. Then what it does is it goes into our primary production system, and every minute and a half, our replica system goes to the primary production system and pulls that information over. The reason we end up using a replica to provide the information to the public is people can turn loose computers on our systems to try to get as much information as they can. That's not unknown. You know, robocalling, you know, when we get that at home, there are actually companies that do that for a living. And so we use our replica data system to provide documents and online access. So if we ever got overwhelmed, it would shut down externally, but it wouldn't shut down the system internally. So staff could still continue to do their job as we're dealing with somebody who got very excited about getting a lot of documents and just kind of slammed into the side of our system. That's the 2 minutes in there. At the same time, it also creates a backup copy of that and sends it to our spare data center down in Douglas.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's, was there a second question, Madam Chair?
Are you going to mention library materials at all?
No, that wasn't on our...
I'll wait and see if there's time later.
Okay. And I'll try to be expeditious as I'm going through these presentations as well. So on our next slide, The benefits of the Oregon eCourt program, obviously we're replacing a 30-year-old OGIN system. It makes the court processes more efficient. It also allows us to automate things. For example, when something gets scanned in, not only does the benefit of it being able to access to the public, but the benefit is it's accessible statewide through OJD, and it goes into a judge's queue, so they have that information available almost immediately. In a court online with Odyssey, once the documents get scanned in or received electronically by the attorneys, you don't have to ask the question, who's got the file? The file is in the system and readily accessible. It also allows, use some of the money to improve our network system so that as we move the data through, we're moving it through very efficiently. For the litigants and stakeholders, 24/7 availability to file. We also have the ability to work on our statewide consistency because, as we know, attorneys generally file in different counties, Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas. So the more we're consistent, the easier it is for them to interact with the courts and for the litigants who do cross-jurisdictional women's resource centers, help centers, who may work in Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, for example, are seeing the same processes in each of those courts or will. Intelligent forms, much like a TurboTax, we're bringing online here soon intelligent forms where were you married, how many kids do you have. It will walk you through the information that the court needs, auto-populate the forms, and then allow you to file those electronically after you've provided some information to the system. That's going to be a boon for self-represented litigants as they're trying to go through a very complicated process, say a dissolution. And then simplified search. We'll get into this a little bit later, but we've moved to a person-based system, not a case-based system. And that has a dynamic as it relates to how somebody interacts across the state. For example, if a warrant is issued in Jackson County in our old system, you had to find that. Now, if a warrant is issued in Jackson County and they walk into Multnomah County, a little flag is going to pop up and say, this person has a warrant in Jackson County. And so that's a person-based system versus case-based system. And then for the public, their information is available more readily. They're able to make payments online. And we've also, as we discussed a little bit ago, we've taken extra steps to make sure that the information we're releasing is taking into account person's privacy as it relates to information we shouldn't be releasing. So the next slide we have over is what's known as our single solution provider approach. And one of the things I'd like to mention in any kind of big technology procurement, as you may be hearing, we went with a deliverables-based contract. That means the vendor delivers us something, we test it, we accept it, we pay for it. We did not do a time and materials contract because we did not believe that that was in the best interest of our branch to do. And so for deliverables-based, we negotiated the contract. They have to provide what we will accept before they get paid, and that has worked out well for us, especially as it relates to scope control, because the vendor is looking at this going, you wanted me to deliver this, and if we change the scope, then that brings into, oh, we want more money for that. With time and materials, and this is just my personal assessment of it, is you can lose scope very quickly before you realize what dollars you're spending on it. So we have a fixed budget, fixed process, fixed deliverables, and I'm pleased to report that our implementations are on time and on budget. But I have a slide for that, and we'll get to that. So very briefly, the single solution, we went with a single solution instead of an integrator because we wanted something that was seamless across the board as it relates to case management, content management, and financial management. And as you'll see from the slide, that also brings in case access, e-filings, the web components, intelligent forms, jury integration frameworks, and session works for the judges. So an integrated solution instead of one solution for case management, one solution for document, and then we try to make it work. I often use the example of a Ford engine and a GM transmission. They should work together, but you're going to have to do a lot to make them work together versus buying a system that works together holistically. And that's what we bought, and that is what has been deployed across other states before we got it. The next slide we have is just an idea of some of the integrations we do. I'd like to call out very briefly. We get our jury information from Secretary of State and DMV. Treasury collections, we work with Department of Revenue. You'll see the OGIN FIAS in the middle of that. That should be OGIN FIAS Odyssey. As OGIN and FIAS go away, Odyssey is slowly replacing those. We interact, as I said, extensively with Treasury and our collection agencies, and also with DOC and the CJC as it relates to criminal convictions and information data that goes that way. So you can see we've got a lot of exchanges. Another exchange is Oregon State Police. If you get stopped and get a ticket, that ticket, once it's in a cell range system, will be uploaded to the court, processed overnight, and you'll be able to pay it online the next day. Before this happened, you'd have to wait till that ticket was delivered to the court, which could take a week or two, and then it had to be entered into the system. Now, in a minimum of 12 hours, you can pay on, plead and pay, and be on your way, which, as a former trial court administrator in Clatsop, that was a big deal. When they had to deliver them, you had to schedule that, and now it's just done automatically, and that's a big integration we've got right now. The next slide you'll see is just a screenshot of our case register system. That's OGIN, 28-year system. It did what it was designed to do, but it was time to move into our next dynamic. And Senator Riley, I would assume you appreciate the screen in front of us here. But this is our COBOL-based system, case register. Again, I'll just highlight case register versus person-based. This was a listing of the actions that took case in a particular case versus what this person did. So our next slide over, you'll see our judge session works. This looks at what a person does holistically through documents filed, case registers. The judge has the ability to make notes on the case. While the judge is looking at the case, other people can be looking at the case and the documents. The public can be looking at the case and the documents. And this has the ability for the judge to really have the full view of what's happening versus a file here, a file there, and a file there. And, oh, we can't find the other file. We're looking for it. And that very rarely happens, but this prevents that from happening in the future.
Madam Chair, if I can add, the OGIN system is basically like having the legislative calendar online. You know that the bill was introduced, it had first reading, it's been referred to judiciary, it has a hearing and a work session scheduled. It's just a listing of events, and there are comment fields where, for the convenience of the court, the clerks would say, judgment entered, pleaded guilty, whatever. And as you know from your legislative system, when I first started working in the legislature, we spent our mornings delivering the third readings and the bill sets and all those documents and run around to all the legislative offices. And now all that's done online, and you have all your committee materials online. You have the amendments available. And the courts are going through a similar process where, instead of getting everything in paper, having to file those, having to locate the file, making sure that that motion is now in the file before it goes to the judge, and if it's not there during the hearing, you know, panic ensues, we have to find that document. Having this automated and being able to tell that this person is before you on an assault 4 case, but also has a family law matter pending and also has a couple other proceedings in that court or another court, or if you have a probation violation in one county and you also have three other counties lined up, that's, as you can imagine, of immense value, not just to the court, but the entire criminal justice system, and helps us work holistically with the people who appear before us. So I just wanted to add that context.
Thank you.
For our next slide, this is the Oregon eCourt rollout schedule. We decided to do a pilot, an early adopter, and velocity stage. Yamhill was our pilot. Crook Jeff Lynn and Jackson were our early adopters. And then we went into what I would call our full steam or velocity stage. And as you can see, we're through Josephine, Douglas, and Marion. In 2 weeks, Lane and Lincoln comes up. When that happens, 68% of what was in OGIN will now be in Odyssey. And so, as you can see, we're scheduled to complete this in June of 16, and I have every intention of completing it on time and on schedule and on budget. And so that just gives you an idea of where we are with the process.
I'm going to interject with a question. Sometimes projects need to be reconfigured a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You have the initial implementation or installation, uh-huh, let's say Yamhill, and you discover, oh, this isn't really the way we thought it was going to be. Or even though that's what we asked for, we realize now that we should have changed our processes a little bit because we could do it even better. But the person designing it designed it exactly like what we asked for, but now that we see it, we want something a little different. Have there been any instances during this implementation that you have made more adjustments beyond what you might have turned up in just a testing phase?
Madam Co-Chair, yes, but in a different way than I think we're walking down the path here. When we procured this, we procured something that was in a product that was in the state of Minnesota, New Mexico. So we knew that other court systems could do this. One of the most amazing things that we did is we adopted what's known as the guiding principles. And it was signed by the Chief Justice, the sponsors, the state court administrator. And what that said was, barring required by law, we will not reconfigure or change the Odyssey system. So if a court said, well, we've done this, we have to do it this way, the response is, well, show me where the statute says that you have to do that. And and our courts are awesome. I was a trial court administrator, but you'd be surprised at how many things happened locally that weren't necessarily required by statute, but were as a result of DA charging practices or whatever we want to talk about. So where we really noticed the big difference was in how our business processes were. We did not ask for a reconfiguration of the Odyssey system. There were some things we had to do from our financials, because Oregon does do accounting a little bit differently. But when we procured this, we had almost 2,200 requirements. We used a team of 22 people to work through our configuration for 9 months before it ever went to Yamhill. So, and we absolutely learned a lot in Yamhill, and we learned a lot in Lynn Crook Jeff, but we never changed the base core product because, one, we were concerned we didn't want to get off the upgrade path. So if Minnesota did something, New Mexico did something, we wanted to take advantage of that. That's what our licensing allows for. And two, the guiding principle said we wouldn't do that. And the guiding principles, there's 13 of them or 12 of them, if I'm not mistaken. But we were able to control scope through the use of our guiding principles. So we learned a lot. We changed some things, but we did it within the dynamic of the program and what we wanted.
Thank you very much for that response. I'm encouraged by that, and I hope that when we see other projects being planned, they can take note of your commitment, your internal commitments, even to each other and internally. Mm. But often we're focusing on commitments with a vendor and how's the contract prepared. But it also has a lot to do, as you've explained very well, at how we decide to stick to a business process and a plan and then implement. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Oh, Brian Baer, Chief Information Officer, Oregon Judicial Department.
Forgive me if I didn't do that earlier. I didn't catch it.
I can add, Madam Co-Chair, the caveat and the thing I'd like to make sure we're clear about here is when Bryant talks about business processes, I talked about, you know, small claims has one process by statute, landlord-tenant has another, criminal has another. Many courts, we have very much like Oregon's government structure generally, the judicial branch has a very much local control aspect to it. And so there are not a lot of statutes or chief justice orders that says you have to do it this way. And so as a result, over the preceding 30 years, many courts do it their own way. And the Odyssey system allows for that because you're not customizing, you're configuring, so you can adapt to your local practice. What we are learning now and what we're going to be asking when we talk about our policy option package to support eCourt as we go from implementation to operation, we want to make those processes more consistent. And we have a lot of interactions with the Oregon State Bar, and as you can imagine, the attorney who lives in Salem but practices in Polk County or practices in Yamhill County. Why do I file documents 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in Yamhill County, and in Marion it's 15432? And that is just a business practice. They're delivering the statutory required information, but the courts locally ask them to do it in a different way. So that is part of the business process analysis and the consistency piece that we are continuing to work toward and will be something that we think will benefit not only the courts but the practitioners, and also be able to give you better data as we work through and talk about our timely disposition standards and how we're doing in this process.
Mm, hooray.
So we want to just let you kind of a quick scorecard on how we're doing. Both of our appellate courts are using their new case management system and have e-filing. The nice thing about e-filing in the appellate courts is our two main consumers are the Department of Justice and the Office of Public Defense Services. So moving from a discretionary e-filing to a mandatory e-filing was pretty easy because 90% or more of the filings come from those two entities. We've been going at this for 3 years. We have circuit courts coming online every 3 months. 25% of all of our payments to the courts are now made online.
And as you can imagine, that's a big savings just in terms of staff time to answer the phone, take down the credit card number, process that check, and do the receipting. Every county has e-pay, e-citations from Oregon State Police, and the intelligent forms for a family abuse protective order. And so those FAPA forms are the first thing we have statewide that's available online. And as we move through more courts and more forms, we'll be adding to that. But we wanted to start with one of our a system that's already available in Multnomah County. We're taking that statewide. As Bryant mentioned, 63% of our cases going on to 68% when we go live with Lane and Lincoln in a couple weeks. 744 business processes, both statewide and in local courts, and that number will keep going up until we get all of our courts on board, and then we start making things more consistent. We will try to shrink those. Almost $1.5 million were paid in January using ePay. 5.2 million documents have been migrated into the Odyssey system. A little more than 15 million cases from OGIN into Odyssey. And so that, I hope, just kind of gives you a little better idea of the scope and scale of the effort that we're undertaking here.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Lehman, as you know, the judicial branch has a lot of money owed to it. And when you're migrating these cases into the new system, is that going to enhance your ability to collect this $1.5 billion or whatever it is?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I don't think the migration itself will do it. Having that all those cases under one person's name, be able to link those better, will help to some extent. As you know, and as we've discussed in the public safety sub over time, a lot of that debt is old and aging rapidly. Some of our judgments go back 50 years, and mm-hmm. they don't expire, and we add more to that every year than we can collect. So this will certainly be an efficiency. As you know, we've automated our collections referrals both to Department of Revenue and to private collection firms.
So eCourt really doesn't address the collections?
It might incrementally. It won't. I don't think it will have a fundamental improvement in that, Senator. So what's left to do? We're going to finish our implementation in the tax court and the 17 circuit courts, again, by June of 2016, if you give us the funding and the resources to do that. We have a go-live event every 3 months until that point. We are doing groups of courts. We are going to complete development of more than 100 statewide business processes, again, to try to make ourselves more efficient and effective and consistent. E-filing is the ability of lawyers and eventually the public to basically send an email with a document into a system that is integrated into the Odyssey case management system. And so every Oregon attorney is now required by Chief Justice order to use e-filing. And when a court goes live, for example, when Lane County goes live, they will in 30 days we will have the ability for lawyers to e-file, and then another 30 business days after that they will be required to e-file. And right now we're up to 40 some plus percent of all mm-hmm. of our filings coming in through e-filing system.
56, if I'm not mistaken.
56. And then the other thing that we're going to be talking about in our policy option packages is as we move from implementation to operation of this system, we need some permanent support for the ongoing maintenance and training supports. So Bryant's going to take over and talk a little bit more about the budget side of this now.
Co-Chair, very quickly, the Oregon eCourt expenditures, you'll see we've gone through 82%. Since the program started, we have 18% left to go. And then what you'll see before you in the next several slides is three policy option packages. Policy option package 301 and 302 work through the Oregon eCourt, the continuation of the Oregon eCourt program through the end. Policy option 302 is just the funding to keep this rolling through June, July, August of 16 until we go through the complete implementation and some of the closeout activities. Policy option package 301 is the obligation for the bonding authority to pay back the debt or to continue to pay back the debt on that. Policy option 311, which we'll spend a little bit more time on, discusses our need for permanent positions as we roll forward in a number of different areas. And one of them is technical operations. As we get a more sophisticated system, we want to take more advantage of it. And so that requires a different level of technical capability and a couple more people to do it, or several more people to do it. In addition, one of the things that we found is, Madam Co-Chair, one of the questions you asked about consistency through the courts as well, we actually formed a consistency committee made up of judges and staff as to what we could do efficiently through the courts, we want to maintain that. We want to look at the training going forward, training going back, make sure that when Minnesota pays for something and we can deploy it, we deploy it, and we deploy it well. That's going to take a certain amount of training staff and financial staff looking forward and looking back as it relates to our system. In addition, because we bought a robust system, there's weekly updates that come out, patches, as we would call them, and versions that come out generally yearly that add enhancements and add functionality to it. And so Policy Option Package 311 discusses our need for for 22.26 FTE and what the expected outcomes of that policy package are. Policy Option 311 supports business processes and training, supporting law changes, and maximizing the benefit from the Oregon eCorp program, technical services to maintain the system, and business services to support it. One of the things that, as this policy option package does, is it helps restore the 15% cut that we also got when budgets were very, very tight. And so it helps us bring us up to speed also on supporting the system and training and deployment and the financial aspects of it.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Baer, the 22.24 FTE that are in the policy option package 302, are those temporary employees or are you going to maintain those?
Those are temporary limited duration positions to support the Oregon eCorp program. Policy option 311, Madam Co-Chair, Senator, is the full-time ones.
And I want to add a question onto that. In my very high-level understanding of eCorp, but I have been tracking it for many years. I've visited places locally as well as in Salem to understand it in detail. But if I had to explain it in a sentence, for example, it seems to me that the benefits are primarily to the public, and they're at the operational level throughout the system, and they benefit local courts as well. The benefit to the judicial department or branch is much less. The benefit, I think, is primarily to everyone else. If that's correct, I guess what I'm asking is, we are often asked to provide additional support for our courts. In a way, this is saying we're taking on some of that support, but instead of giving it directly to the court, we are now assuming the responsibility for some of this, where we have now improved the situation for you. We've relieved a number of burdens, routine tasks, things that caused a lot of grief for the public, for attorneys, for judges. So the court system becomes much more efficient locally, but we're now taking on the financial responsibility. Is that a fair analysis?
Madam Co-Chair, I would say yes, but one of the things that as we work through this is from a statewide perspective, I would like to take the low-hanging fruit would be the best. You know, if I can automate a process, OSP, e-sites, e-payments, those type of things that then in turn free up the local staff to deal with local issues, victims, to deal with people who have intellectual or language barriers, to focus on the things that really make the biggest impact. And so what we're looking for in Policy Option Package 301-1 are two different things. One, how can I relieve that the more the burden of things that I can automate that then allows them to focus on the actual, because I'm not interacting with the public every day. I'm interacting with systems that help the public in one perspective, but don't answer the victim who comes through the door and says, I need some help. And so I guess that would be my yes is I'd like to automate things where I can and free those staff up to do what they really need to do.
Thank you.
And that's what we'd like to do.
Thank you. And then my other question is, when eCorp was proposed long, long ago, there would have been some thought to what's it going to take to maintain mm-hmm. such a system. How does this package, this request for approximately 20 FTE and this amount of money, how does that compare to what you may have asked for or anticipated when you first requested starting on this path?
Madam Co-Chair, I'd have to pull out what we specifically asked for. I don't have that right off the top of my head. From my personal experience, I think that the robustness of what we bought, we underestimated a little bit. This is a very powerful system, especially as it relates to person-based and as it relates to efficiencies that we can gain, especially with our externals. And so I believe we underestimated that a little bit, not very much, but a little bit. And that's one of the things I'd really like to take advantage of. I tend to like to call people on a phone, listen to a dial tone, and I don't like texting my daughter. She don't leave me a voicemail, just call and hang up, and I'll see your name there. And so I like to when you think of things that way, those are baseline products, and I like to focus on those, and I think that we can definitely take advantage of more of what this product offers in advance or in accomplishing what we need to do. And it's a convoluted answer, I know, but I think that maximizing the robust is what I'd really like to do.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McSpadden, you probably get the drift of my question. Is this a lot more than what we thought earlier we'd be getting into?
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I don't have that information with me. Certainly I can work with the legislative fiscal office staff and the agency and get that information to the members probably in the next few days.
I want you to understand it's really just a budget question.
Sure.
I'm extremely pleased with the project, the on time, on budget. It works as designed. The ease with which you were able to do this, the drive towards standardization where you can for such a humongous, complex project, it's turning out well so far, and I'm really happy to see that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if
please.
I may. Thank you. I'm also very pleased with how this is going. I've been out of the legislature for 4 years, but I saw this when it started. Mm-hmm. And now I see it as it's coming to its fruition, and I'm very impressed. One of the slides earlier was very brought back some old memories, the hanging folders and the I designed and wrote the court following system for Superior Court in California, so I recognize those folders, but that was many years ago, and what you have now is pretty amazing, and I'm glad to see that we're moving that way. And I also approve of, you know, did we get more than we asked for? Yeah, okay. I'm okay with that. and it takes a little more to maintain it, but we have to be careful and not do things that we can't afford.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're about ready to wrap up, it looks like.
With committee's permission, I'd like to wrap up. As it relates to information technology, as you've seen through this presentation, and I apologize if we've run a little bit long, OJD interactive and involved diverse leadership, involving the courts, the Chief Justice, the State Court Administrator, the guiding principles, that helped this project move forward in a number of different ways very successfully. Stable enterprise systems with failover capability. I have a failover site in Douglas County that we've been able to test and fail over the Odyssey system in under 15 minutes. So once the management decision has been made to fail over, I can be back up and running, tested in 15 minutes. Diligent monitoring of our enterprise network and data systems as it relates to security. We have various different firewalls. We have an information security office that makes sure that our systems and data are as secure as they possibly can be. And with the successful deployment of the appellate and trial court systems. And so with that, thank you for having us here, and we're available for any questions.
Other questions? Yes,
I just have one. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I am getting a number of calls from constituents and folks who are not constituents concerned about how quickly they can access some of this.
Mm-hmm.
They have not been able to. Some of them, as I said, are constituents in terms of Multnomah County, but other folks who I've been in contact with, especially in Clatsop and Columbia counties, which is apparently up and running in 2013, from what I can gather. What should I tell them? Why are they having problems? Well, I guess the issue is not so much having problems getting into the system, but because the system is now up and running, they figure they should be getting moving along on their court cases of one form or another faster than they have been.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative, I'm sensing that there were two issues that maybe put on the table. One is accessing the system as it relates to accessing the documents or information as it relates to the court is one. And then the second one is, how do I get my case moving along faster? I can definitely, for the first one, please feel free to give them my name, and I'm happy to share that with you. I was the former trial court administrator for Clatsop County, so Clatsop County holds a deep place in my heart for service. And so I'm happy to answer if there's some sort of technical problem that we need to work through. One thing that we have found is that while we can operate pretty quickly, some people's computers, law offices or personal computers, may not operate as fast as we can. And so what happens is when they're expecting something to happen, their internet may not be as stable as ours is, and so that can create a delay in how the information is displayed or the access. So the short answer is please feel free to give them my name and information, and I will absolutely contact them or have somebody do contact them.
Actually, it appears, pardon me, a follow-up, it appears that it's actually more the human computer interface than the computer itself, that the system is moving along in some cases, but the judges are overwhelmed by the number of cases, and so as a result, they don't get a chance to get through to things, and that they delay and delay and delay, and they create some problems.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, if I can add, when we do a go-live process, the work of the court does not stop. And so we start more than a year out and start meeting with the court staff, with the judges, with the local bar, with the stakeholders, and kind of explain what they can expect and when. When we get within a couple weeks of the actual go-live, as is going on in Lane and Lincoln counties now, we deliberately slow down the docket. So, you know, you would not hold as many hearings and work sessions. Your floor sessions would be more selective, just to make sure that the staff can focus on getting that training and getting the material migrated from one system to another. Once that process is done on the go-live date, the dockets slowly start coming back up, but we are still working to make sure. I mean, this is the flip side of being a robust system, it's a complicated system, and you have to learn to use it, and it takes time to go from training speed to full speed and kind of get your stuff back. And that can take months. And the only thing I can tell you is that every court is a little different. We work with them to try to set expectations appropriately, but everyone thinks that once you got a computer, you know, things are going to go quickly. But it is a process. It is complex. Staff and judges both have to learn how to use it. The bar has to learn how to use it, and it's an ongoing process. Not too long ago, the Chief Justice went back to Linn County for their one-year anniversary working on Odyssey. And everybody they hadn't forgot the birthing pains of this system, but they all agreed to a judge, to every staff person, said they would not go back. And that, to us, is kind of the telling point. On the on the access piece, the other thing I would just put in front of you is we have been pretty cautious and deliberate about what information we make available to the general public. And so some users, for example, law enforcement agencies, have access to almost anything because we have that security both in terms of who we're dealing with and what they're dealing with, and we don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. As we move on to other business interests, other personal interests, we are moving very deliberately to make sure that we're not disclosing things that we ought not be disclosing or that are going to cause problems to disclose. And so some of the people you may hear from are those who want information that's available in there, but we're not ready to put out on a wholesale basis. And so I don't know if that was really part of your question, that is a dynamic.
The several different cases that I'm talking about,
And again, if you want to call us over, we'd be glad to chat with you or to refer to your constituents directly. So
absolutely.
Just so that you understand, one of the cases, though, dealt with foreclosure fight. The judge had some information, didn't pass it along. Then when they finally got the information, they tried to get into the system to find out more, still didn't get things done in a timely manner, and they continued to be sort of on hold for months before they got any real good answers, and they still haven't gotten
Representative Frederick, I apologize, but we're a little bit late the next session. I hope that you will follow up with Representative Frederick to better understand what's going on and what can be done to resolve this situation.
I apologize for taking the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, next up we have legislative administration. And if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for having us today. I'm Kevin Hayden, legislative administrator. And although the majority of the time, Shansi Sabin, our CIO, will be doing the talking, I at least wanted to kick off the introduction and talk a little bit about what our agenda here was today, and specifically what I'm going to be talking about is the governance of how we lead in and run with leading our program here at the legislature. So our IS Governance Board was established some years ago and involves all of the agency heads, the parliamentarians, the caucus administrators and chiefs of staff, so the presiding officer, as well as representation from the CIO, so that it is chaired by myself. And our goal is to align the business and our IS goals. Too often, you know, the running joke in the world is that IS runs the rest of us and comes in and tells us we have to change our computers, we have to change our software, we have to do all kinds of things. This approach really brings in the leadership and of the governance board, the rest of us. The business has a great deal of say in where we want IS to focus their resources and where we want them to work as we move forward throughout. And it's a very collaborative process. So IS can bring forward an issue if there's a system that is aging and it's time to bring it into a new system, or any one of the agencies or any of the members can come in and say, there's a system that we use that we think we need to change, or something needs to be done better with, or we have a business need, and they can straight it just in that manner, that what the business need is, so that IS can then focus on it and move forward. We meet four times a year, and we most of this last year have been focusing a lot of our time on disaster recovery. That's not the right term. Disaster recovery and continuation of services has been a topic that we've been taking back to the board so that we could get a real feel for the business as to what their needs are and where they would go. So everything isn't just about software itself, it's about continuity of operation. So with that.
For the record, I'm Shansi Sabin, CIO for Legislative Administration. Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, committee members, thank you for having us here to share an overview of technology at the legislature. I wanted to start with the strategic technology plan. We implemented this plan in June of 2010. It's a five-year plan, and it takes us through June of 2015. This was important because it's a roadmap. It allowed us to talk to the business, talk to IT at that point in time, and IT staff, a few members, the different agencies that we support, and identify what was the priority to the business at that time. We put that plan on paper and shared it with the governance board, and we've used that plan as a roadmap over the last 5 years. As of last fall, we've completed 82% of the action items that we've set out in that plan. So there are five overall goal areas with 56 specific action items in that plan. And the plan also kind of mapped out what our strengths and weaknesses were as well. And we created a vision statement, and specifically what I wanted to share is our strategic objectives, because it was really important to us that we as an IT department were in alignment. Those three strategic objectives that we identified were service excellence, We have outstanding technologists that service the legislature and are very, very focused on being responsive to the needs of their customers. Continuous improvement was the next area that was really important, not just improving the technology, but improving the skill sets of the staff that provide the technology as well as the processes that we use. And the third...
Excuse me, Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for interrupting. I'm going to have to go to another meeting, and I have three questions, if I might, Madam Chair. First, it's my understanding that the... like the staff measure summaries are at four levels. There's the committee chair, the committee members, the public level, and the building level. Could you discuss in context how the timing of the disclosure, is it simultaneous or is it sequential? Is it the content of the disclosure, is it the same that goes to the committee chair as it goes to the committee, as it goes to the public? And also the how are the process goes from the preliminary SMS to then the fiscal to the revenue and then comes back. And can you describe that? Because the reason for our concern is we're not getting the SMSs. We're not getting them until sometime, you know, just before the hearing begins during a meeting. So can you discuss that for us, please?
Yeah, thank you for your question, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Whitsitt. And I appreciate your question because this leads into the strategic objective about aligning with the business. And when OLIS was developed, it was based on feedback from the business. And so when it was developed, there was a desire for the committees to be able to receive materials at one of these different levels. They can put it in at any level at any point in time. So it's really up to the committee what level those meeting materials and information go into. They determine that typically they go at the chair level. Those materials go in at the chair level. And then the chair level determines when they release them to the committee level and then on to the business and then on to the public. It's my understanding in talking to committees, committee services staff primarily, that they often don't even use the committee level and the business level, that things go in at the chair level and then move directly to public. And I think that things are just moving so fast in this legislative session that committees is working to keep up and to process all of that information through those levels based on the request of the chair.
Follow up, please. First, just a comment. I understand things are going fast, but most of us who like to read the bills would like to have the staff summary, the fiscal and the revenue, so that we can look at that before we read the bill, because it saves a lot of time. And so it is hamstringing our ability to do a good job by not having this material in a timely manner. The second question has to do with your staffing. It appears that you're struggling to maintain staff. I believe that you've changed your executive development manager three times sequentially, and three of your six developmental people have left. So can you explain what's going on there and what effect that's having on the fact that we're not getting our SMMs when we want them?
You want to take that or you want me to jump in?
So, well, there, thank you for the question, Chair Nathanson, Senator Whitsitt. Since I've been here, we had our enterprise applications manager is the manager that you're talking about, and she did leave. We brought someone else in. They turned around and went back to where we had hired them from. So we just have recently hired a new enterprise application manager who really is bringing a lot to the organization. So anytime you lose someone, obviously there's a struggle, and it's not necessarily it's made harder when you're a small organization like our own. Since I've been here, Shancy has been working on looking at our compensation plan for IS, the state as a whole, as far as compensation for IS employees, really does seem to drag behind the public sector. So in some degrees, we're fighting money. In some degrees, we're fighting atmosphere.
Have these people left the private sector?
One has gone to state. We've lost in the developers that you asked about to the private sector or to state. They've gone to other places. So that's one part. Another is the rhythm of work here versus where say developers or other people can work, and the state is still, although it's not the 1950s, we're a little more rigid in our view of employees, and that we need people to be here at certain times. It's less, a little less flexible than in other places, but we have better benefits than maybe you might get in other places. So we, with the addition of the new Enterprise Applications Manager, we've also taken on a different hiring role, in that we're looking at the potential of contract to hire versus just trying to hire straight out, so that we can bring people in, test them, and make sure that they understand kind of the atmosphere that we work in, and that they're a good addition, and that they meld well with the development team. I'm sure that developers would tell you that they are as much artists as technicians here, or anywhere. So their ability to work together and work together smoothly is just as important as having five really great developers. Mm-hmm. So
I guess to get to the crux of the matter, is this staffing problem what's holding up the timely production of the materials that we need, or is it something wrong with the strategic objective? Is something wrong with the process? I mean, because we're not getting them.
I think that to one degree, I know I talked to Committee Services, to Rick Bercobian earlier today, and I know that with this session, he's just updated, you know, their FAQs as to how the processes should work also. So part of it is process in nature, to make sure that we are following the same process every time, so that you get the materials that you need when you need them. I don't know. As far as the development staff, I don't think that is as much of a driver here, but it's.
I'm going to interject. It seems to me that from something that Ms. Sabin said a few minutes earlier, it seems that we allow for some variation in how a committee or a committee chair handles materials, and maybe that's a type of procedural question, procedural policy that should be revisited if there's a problem with members not having
Madam
access.
Madam Chair, it's pretty systemic within our Senate Republican caucus that we're not getting the materials in a
I understand.
Fashion.
I'm just
so perhaps I could just get offline with you sometime, sit down, Mr. Hayden, and talk and figure this out.
There may be some. Suggesting there may be some process policies that need to be revisited.
Well, I'm just looking
on how people
I'm
are
sure,
handling it.
I'm certain
it.
There is some problem. I just like to try to find out what it is. So. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good question. Thank you.
All right.
Certainly. I'm looking at the time. We have only 20 minutes. I've looked at the next several slides, which are pretty much just here's who we are.
Yeah.
I'm going to request that you skip forward to the slides are not numbered, but I think it's 12. I think that's where we get to some really interesting stuff. If
okay.
You could skip to that one.
Absolutely. Would you like to touch on this
one.
At all?
Okay.
Yeah. So we have several different platforms of applications that we support. Currently, these applications require modernization efforts. The Forms and Reports 11G, as you can see, include most of our core legislative applications. These were transitioned from the mainframe to Forms and Reports around the 1999 timeframe through a technology transition project. We do have a vendor coming on site in March of 2015 to help us with that roadmap and that path to look at how we migrate those to our current technology platform. We do have one application left on the mainframe. It's about a 30-year-old application, and that is bill drafting, and it's the oldest application in use at the legislature and one of the most critical. Legislative Council is engaged in developing a technology initiation request to redevelop that application. And as Kevin had mentioned earlier in the governance process, that request includes the business need, the value, helps identify the impacts, the costs, and moving forward with the development of that application.
I'm guessing it's not going to help with plain language statutes, though, is it?
In 2010, we identified that the forms and reports platform was end-of-lifing, so we upgraded to the most current platform so that we could extend the life of those applications, and the development team was tasked with identifying the development platform moving forward. That .NET was identified as that platform, and as you can see, there's a number of applications in use today that we've developed in the last 5 years. OLIS, which you all use, being one of the primary applications in use today, the Fiscal Impact Revenue Impact System, Staff Measure System, which Senator Whitsett referred to, Public Bill Notification, Legislative Information Member System, Replication, Delinquent Accounts, and then also we have refreshed our web environment. So we rolled out the new internet site in the fall of 2013 and are using the same SharePoint platform that the executive branch is using. OLIS, in the first 3 weeks of session, we had over 790,000 page views on that site, so it's being heavily used. On the internet itself, we had about 366,000 page views. So those resources are heavily being used by the public. Public Bill Notification was an application that was developed based on that original strategic technology plan, and that was rolled out this year. We have 2,875 subscribers and within the first 3 weeks of this session, and 899,000 emails were sent out notifying public of those bill status changes. In addition to that, we have several commercial off-the-shelf systems, so we're always trying to look at what's the best fit in our environment. Is it a commercial off-the-shelf solution? Is it something we need to develop internally? Are there cloud-hosted applications? So we're constantly looking at what best meets the business environment. And so you can see here a number of commercial off-the-shelf systems. A few of them were new within this last biennium audio-video system. That solution itself replaced five legacy systems that we were keeping held together, and has allowed us to offer additional features and functionality to the public as well in being able to view the video and link to specific text in the video as well. Do you have any questions about the major applications that we support?
Representative.
This is just a little question. At the beginning of the session, I requested that there be a rule change be made to require that amendments to bills be have an author identified to them the same way you have a sponsor of a bill. And I was told that they couldn't do that because of limitations of the software. Can you comment on that? And you were saying, I assume that's part of the bill drafting system. There are amendments kind of in the bill kind of thing. Is that something that could be fixed in the future, and is that a system limitation?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Nierman, that is absolutely possible in the system. We would just want the business to request that. I know we did make a change, in fact, last week to how amendment posting works and making sure that the date of posting is made viewable when it is made public. So the technology is there. We just need to make sure the business is requesting that be added.
Good. Thank you.
Yes. So we do have one proposed policy option package. We had one last biennium as well. and that is related to disaster recovery, as Kevin had alluded to earlier. We spent a little time with the IT governance board educating them, doing a risk appetite survey to identify, you know, what information do we need to get up quickly in the event of a business interruption, a major business interruption or disaster. This is not continuity planning, so it's not planning for the business. It's just protecting our data, getting a site set up off-site so that we can recover. We do backups, of course, and that was in some earlier slides. We do store those off-site, and the governance board approved moving forward with a proposal or a request for a policy option package to move forward with a cold site. And you can see that the cost per biennium is about $106,000. So that is the one policy option package that we feel is really important to protect the data and the information at the legislature in the event of a disaster. And what's next? So we are obviously going to be creating a new strategic technology plan to take us into the next 5 years. We really want to spend time focusing on quality. That's the one thing that's consistently come up. I skipped our project methodology and controls that we have in our project management process internally, but that's the one thing that we've identified that's been consistent in our evaluations, is really taking our time with quality assurance and testing, really taking our time with requirements definition, and really making sure that we get that information right. We have several project priorities that you can see are identified here. The rewrite of FISRIS, that was our first .NET application, and we've identified some efficiencies that are required, and that redevelopment will help re-architect that application. So that was approved by the governance board. The planning, which I mentioned, for the forms and report migration. A member portal. This is something that we've talked about at the governance board, and we're working on clarification on what that is. That application is the intention of that, and based on feedback from the customer relationship advisors who work directly with the members and members' offices, is an application with a single interface that will pull information together most commonly used by members, including potentially my documents, my committees, calendar view, legislative concepts, so they're in one location and not delivered through email, and the ability to sponsor and unsponsor bills. So we're still working on vetting that out, but that's something that continues to come back to us through the customer relationship advisors and has been presented to the governance board. So we're working on a little bit more information to continue to work on that effort as well. Rewrite measure tracking, that application has been in place since the early 2000s, excuse me. And the last one is witness sign-in. So there was a bill passed last biennium that required witness sign-in to be electronic. In the meantime, Committee Services has scanned and uploaded the witness sign-in, so it is under meeting materials and it's there, but the intent was to have that electronic so people could sign in electronically and see who they're representing and have it automatically updated in OLIS. So that is the next priority that's been prioritized by the IT Governance Board. Those are subject to change as we work with the governance board and continue to finalize that strategic technology plan as well.
Would you please repeat or say a bit more about forms and report migration?
Yeah. So we have, as you can see, many of our core legislative applications are on the Forms and Reports platform. And desks, CAS, LC dockets, amend and repeal, indexing, measure tracking, publications, and secured electronic delivery. And that platform is near end of life. And so what we're doing is we're working with a vendor to help us map out that migration strategy, migrating from or forms and reports to .NET and what that path looks like, because there's different functionality on both platforms. Currently in forms and reports, a lot of the code logic is stored in the database, where .NET, it's more in the application. So we're really wanting to do some due diligence to work with that vendor to identify what that roadmap looks like before we venture down that path of migrating any of those data, those applications. And we also really want to take a look at, are there commercial off-the-shelf applications for any of those that may meet our needs too, prior to firming up a migration plan?
It seems that this is either largely or entirely the outward-facing view of the legislature. It's about the bills that we're hearing and passing. the legislative work we're doing. I'm kind of wondering, what about forms and reports that are internal to the business operations of the legislative branch? Financial stuff, human resources, requests for maintenance work. I've actually noticed an absence of automation in almost all of those areas, but where do you address automating and updating the business of the legislative branch, not the outward-facing legislative work or statutory work?
Co-Chair Nathanson, currently we actually use DAS's systems for SFMS for financials and accounts payable. Mm-hmm. And you know, those are on a mainframe platform. We use their payroll system, their HR system. And I know Lori Christopher, our employee services manager, is actively engaged in the project to evaluate, participate in the process of looking at those new HR systems, because that would help us with our automation as well. So, and this has been longstanding that we've used those DAS systems, so we have not looked at bringing those in-house, but rather with working with the executive branch on determining how can we help move those along and automate more of those processes.
And to add to that, you know, I've been here about 2 years, and when I got here, and Karen Hupp down in HR handed me my timesheet and said, "You have to keep track of your time on a timesheet every day," I was astounded. So one of the things that, because we're using the back end of our HR and all of that through DAS, is that's why the TrackStar program was implemented, so that we could do timekeeping for the majority of our staff. It's not a perfect, it's a bolt on at the front end, but it makes an efficiency for us to manage it. And it's not perfect for HR. There's still a lot of manual intervention going on the back end. But those are the kinds of things that we're seeing, that we can make those little corrections. It's because we're part of the larger HR system, we really need to get there. And, of course, that's my bread and butter, being an HR guy working on HR systems for the 30 years before I came here. I would love to move forward, and we've had those conversations, but we have to continue to work forward with DAS on those.
Senator.
Thank you. The one question I have in all of this, and actually there's a lot, but one I'll ask, is the governance board that you referenced, the same governance board as the executive, is that the governance board you're looking at? Who is your governance board?
Good question, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley. Our governance board that I talked about is our governance board. It's I chair it. It's made up of the legislative agency directors, so Paul Warner, Ken Rocco, Dexter Johnson, the parliamentarians, the chief clerk and the secretary of the Senate, and then the caucus administrators from the four caucuses, and the presiding officers, chiefs of staff. So that governance board that we're working with is our internal to our workings. And although we can talk about these issues and we can bring them forward and make recommendations outside, we don't actually control when they move forward on those projects for the systems that we use for financials and for payroll and HR.
Thank you.
I have one other question for you related to staffing, and we did skip over some of that. At what point, you mentioned improving the skill sets of staff, but I'm pretty sure you were talking about your staff being able to manage IT stuff within your realm. What do you do to help improve skill sets of all the other staff in the legislative branch? For example, we have many staff coming and going from legislative offices with varying familiarity with Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel. They'll all say they know how to do it, but they use Excel to make a list and don't know how to even do a formula. So what do you make available? Do you have briefings or seminars for staff and say, here's some online, I don't know whether you even purchase it, but when we purchase rights to software, does that come with like online training programs so that they could click on a link and walk through how to make better use of that or how to do an online poll to find a meeting time instead of 50 different phone calls, that sort of thing. How can you help the staff in the building, whether it's legislative offices or other offices, use technology that exists?
Well, thank you for your question, Co-Chair Nathanson. I understand a little over 5 years ago, there was a training position in the IT department, and that position was eliminated at that time. And so we recently realigned some positions. We had a person leave that was doing some internet content contribution. We were able to hire a trainer / quality assurance position to help us really focus on training on enterprise applications like training on OLIS and measure tracking and internal applications, but also on some of those office applications. We also on our intranet site on the technology page, we post all of those tutorials on Word and Excel and PowerPoint. So when people do call our office, we refer them to that. Now we have an opportunity to set up and create custom training for our users as well. So we're tackling it from a couple of different avenues, but it is important that all of the staff that work in the legislature understand and know how to use all the resources that are available to them.
And the trainer came on just at the beginning of session.
Mm-hmm. Well, end of December.
Yeah. And end of December, yeah. So just before session started. So he has hit the ground running, and part of our new employee onboarding program, he's going down and is part of that. So it's exposing people to him. Mm-hmm. And then something that was going on here even before that, which was helpful and is I think one of the greatest things that we do here, the customer advisors that actually come out, the three people, that's, you know, Bud and Chris and Aram, who come out and interact with people, are kind of the eyes and ears, and they can hear where those problems are. And they're doing a lot of spot kind of quick training, you know, as they go. You know, it's not the organized, but it is. They are out and about and helping people. This new addition really does help to also give us the backbone to be the more organized training part.
Great.
And of course, one of the problems with training in this setting is the turnover and the fact that we're only here part of the time.
Absolutely.
It's a huge problem for training. It's just amazing.
It's good to know, though, that materials are available, online help is available. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Other questions? You did get to the end of your slide.
Yes, thank you.
Do you have anything, Mr. McSpaden, to add to this presentation?
I don't, Chair Nathanson. I don't.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else for the committee? We're adjourned. We're adjourned.